And you imagine he would have accepted such a deed as a substitute for 2,300 rubles in cash? He certainly would have accepted it, Mitya declared warmly. Why, look here, he might have grabbed not 2,000, but 4 or 6, for it. He would have put his lawyers, Poles and Jews, onto the job, and might have got, not 3,000, but the whole property out of the old man. The evidence of Pan Mushilovich was, of course, entered in the protocol in the fullest detail. Then they let the Poles go. The incident of the cheating at cards was hardly touched upon. Nikolay Parfenovich was too well pleased with them, as it was, and did not want to worry them with trifles. Moreover, it was nothing but a foolish, drunken quarrel over cards. There had been drinking and disorder enough, that night. So the 200 rubles remained in the pockets of the Poles. Then old Maximov was summoned. He came in timidly, approached with little steps, looking very disheveled and depressed. He had, all this time, taken refuge below with Grushenka, sitting dumbly beside her, and now and then he'd begin blubbering over her and wiping his eyes with a blue check handkerchief, as Mihail Makarovich described afterwards. So that she herself began trying to pacify and comfort him. The old man at once confessed that he had done wrong, that he had borrowed 10 rubles in my poverty, from Dmitri Fyodorovich, and that he was ready to pay it back. To Nikolay Parfenovich's direct question, had he noticed how much money Dmitri Fyodorovich held in his hand, as he must have been able to see the sum better than anyone when he took the note from him, Maximov, in the most positive manner, declared that there was 20,000. Have you ever seen so much as 20,000 before, then? Inquired Nikolay Parfenovich, with a smile. To be sure I have, not 20, but 7, when my wife mortgaged my little property. She'd only let me look at it from a distance, boasting of it to me. It was a very thick bundle, all rainbow, colored notes. And Dmitri Fyodorovich's were all rainbow, colored. He was not kept long. At last it was Grushenka's turn. Nikolay Parfenovich was obviously apprehensive of the effect her appearance might have on Mitya, and he muttered a few words of admonition to him, but Mitya bowed his head in silence, giving him to understand that he would not make a scene. Mihail Makarovich himself led Grushenka in. She entered with a stern and gloomy face, that looked almost composed, and sat down quietly on the chair offered her by Nikolay Parfenovich. She was very pale, she seemed to be cold, and wrapped herself closely in her magnificent black shawl. She was suffering from a slight feverish chill, the first symptom of the long illness which followed that night. Her grave air, her direct earnest look and quiet manner made a very favorable impression on everyone. Nikolay Parfenovich was even a little bit fascinated. He admitted himself, when talking about it afterwards, that only then had he seen how handsome the woman was, for, though he had seen her several times, he had always looked upon her as something of a provincial hetera. She has the manners of the best society, he said enthusiastically, gossiping about her in a circle of ladies. But this was received with positive indignation by the ladies, who immediately called him a naughty man, to his great satisfaction. As she entered the room, Grushenka only glanced for an instant at Mitya, who looked at her uneasily. But her face reassured him at once. After the first inevitable inquiries and warnings, Nikolay Parfenovich asked her, hesitating a little, but preserving the most courteous manner, on what terms she was with the retired lieutenant, Dmitri Fyodorovich Karamazov. To this Grushenka firmly and quietly replied, he was an acquaintance. He came to see me as an acquaintance during the last month. To further inquisitive questions she answered plainly and with complete frankness, that, though at times she had thought him attractive, she had not loved him, but had won his heart as well as his old father's in my nasty spite, that she had seen that Mitya was very jealous of Fyodor Pavlovich and everyone else, but that had only amused her. She had never meant to go to Fyodor Pavlovich, she had simply been laughing at him. I had no thoughts for either of them all this last month. I was expecting another man who had wronged me. But I think, she said in conclusion, that there's no need for you to inquire about that, nor for me to answer you, for that's my own affair." Nikolay Parfenovich immediately acted upon this hint. He again dismissed the romantic aspect of the case and passed to the serious one, that is, to the question of most importance, concerning the 3,000 rubles. Grushenka confirmed the statement that 3,000 rubles had certainly been spent on the first carousal at Mokrow, and, though she had not counted the money herself, she had heard that it was 3,000 from Dmitri Fyodorovich's own lips. "Did he tell you that alone, or before someone else, or did you only hear him speak of it to others in your presence?" the prosecutor inquired immediately. To which Grushenka replied that she had heard him say so before other people, and had heard him say so when they were alone. "Did he say it to you alone once, or several times?" inquired the prosecutor, and learned that he had told Ippolit Kirillovich was very well satisfied with this piece of evidence. Further examination elicited that Grushenka knew, too, where that money had come from, and that Dmitri Fyodorovich had got it from Katerina Ivanovna. "And did you never, once, hear that the money spent a month ago was not 3,000, but less, and that Dmitri Fyodorovich had saved half that sum for his own use?" "No, I never heard that," answered Grushenka. It was explained further that Mitya had, on the contrary, often told her that he hadn't a farthing. "He was always expecting to get some from his father," said Grushenka in conclusion. "Did he never say before you?" Casually, or in a moment of irritation, Nikolay Parfenovich put in suddenly, that he intended to make an attempt on his father's life. "Look, he did say so," sighed Grushenka. "Once or several times?" "He mentioned it several times, always in anger."
"And did you believe he would do it?"
"No, I never believed it," she answered firmly. "I had faith in his noble heart." "Gentlemen, allow me," cried Mitya suddenly, "allow me to say one word to Agrafena Alexandrovna, in your presence."
"You can speak," Nikolay Parfenovich assented.
"Agrafena Alexandrovna?" Mitya got up from his chair, "have faith in God and in me. I am not guilty of my father's murder." Having uttered these words, Mitya sat down again on his chair. Grushenka stood up and crossed herself devoutly before the icon. "Thanks be to thee, O Lord," she said, in a voice thrilled with emotion, and still standing, she turned to Nikolay Parfenovich and added, "as he has spoken now, believe it. I know him. He'll say anything as a joke or from obstinacy, but he'll never deceive you against his conscience. He's telling the whole truth, you may believe it."
"Thanks, Agrafena Alexandrovna, you've given me fresh courage," Mitya responded in a quivering voice.
"As to the money spent the previous day, she declared that she did not know what sum it was, but had heard him tell several people that he had 3,000 with him. And to the question where he got the money, she said that he had told her that he had stolen it from Katerina Ivanovna, and that she had replied to that he hadn't stolen it, and that he must pay the money back next day. On the prosecutor's asking her emphatically whether the money he said he had stolen from Katerina Ivanovna was what he had spent yesterday, or what he had squandered here a month ago, she declared that he meant the money spent a month ago, and that that was how she understood him. Grushenka was at last released, and Nikolay Parfenovich informed her impulsively that she might at once return to the town and that if he could be of any assistance to her, with horses for example, or if she would care for an escort, he would be.
"I thank you sincerely," said Grushenka, bowing to him. "I'm going with this old gentleman, I am driving him back to town with me, and meanwhile, if you'll allow me, I'll wait below to hear what you decide about Dmitri Fyodorovich." She went out. Mitya was calm, and even looked more cheerful, but only for a moment. He felt more and more oppressed by a strange physical weakness. His eyes were closing with fatigue. The examination of the witnesses was, at last, over. They proceeded to a revision of the protocol. Mitya got up, moved from his chair to the corner by the curtain, lay down on a large chest covered with a rug, and instantly fell asleep. He had a strange dream, utterly out of keeping with the place and the time. He was driving somewhere in the steppes, where he had been stationed long ago, and a peasant was driving him in a cart with a pair of horses, through snow and sleet. He was cold, it was early in November, and the snow was falling in big wet flakes, melting as soon as it touched the earth. And the peasant drove him smartly. He had a fair, long beard. He was not an old man, somewhere about 50, and he had on a grey peasant's smock. Not far off was a village. He could see the black huts, and half the huts were burnt down, there were only the charred beams sticking up. And as they drove in, there were peasant women drawn up along the road, a lot of women, a whole row, all thin and wan, with their faces a sort of brownish color, especially one at the edge, a tall, bony woman, who looked 40, but might have been only 20, with a long thin face. And in her arms was a little baby crying. And her breasts seemed so dried up that there was not a drop of milk in them. And the child cried and cried, and held out its little bare arms, with its little fists blue from cold. "Why are they crying? Why are they crying?" Mitya asked, as they dashed gaily by. "It's the babe," answered the driver, "the babe weeping." And Mitya was struck by his saying, in his peasant way, "the babe," and he liked the peasants calling it a babe. There seemed more pity in it. "But why is it weeping?" Mitya persisted stupidly. "Why are its little arms bare? Why don't they wrap it up? The babe's cold, its little clothes are frozen and don't warm it. But why is it? Why?" Foolish Mitya still persisted. "Why, they're poor people, burnt out. They've no bread. They're begging because they've been burnt out." "No, no," Mitya, as it were, still did not understand. "Tell me, why does those poor mothers stand there? Why are people poor? Why is the babe poor? Why is the steppe barren? Why don't they hug each other and kiss? Why don't they sing songs of joy? Why are they so dark from black misery? Why don't they feed the babe?" And he felt that, though his questions were unreasonable and senseless, yet he wanted to ask just that, and he had to ask it just in that way. And he felt that a passion of pity, such as he had never known before, was rising in his heart, that he wanted to cry, that he wanted to do something for them all, so that the babe should weep no more, so that the dark, faced, dried, up mother should not weep, that no one should shed tears again from that moment, and he wanted to do it at once, regardless of all obstacles, with all the recklessness of the Karamazovs. "And I'm coming with you. I won't leave you now for the rest of my life, I'm coming with you." He heard close beside him Grushenka's tender voice, thrilling with emotion. And his heart glowed, and he struggled forward towards the light, and he longed to live, to go on, towards the new, beckoning light, and to hasten, hasten, now, at once. "What? Where?" he exclaimed, opening his eyes, and sitting up on the chest, as though he had revived from a swoon, smiling brightly. Nikolai Parfenovich was standing over him, suggesting that he should hear the protocol read aloud and sign it. Mitya guessed that he had been asleep an hour or more, but he did not hear Nikolai Parfenovich. He was suddenly struck by the fact that there was a pillow under his head, which hadn't been there when he had leant back, exhausted, on the chest. "Who put that pillow under my head? Who was so kind?" he cried, with a sort of ecstatic gratitude, and tears in his voice, as though some great kindness had been shown him. He never found out who this kind man was, perhaps one of the peasant witnesses, or Nikolai Parfenovich's little secretary, had compassionately thought to put a pillow under his head, but his whole soul was quivering with tears. He went to the table and said that he would sign whatever they liked. "I've had a good dream, gentlemen," he said in a strange voice, with a new light, as of joy, in his face. Chapter 9. They carry Mitya away. When the protocol had been signed, Nikolai Parfenovich turned solemnly to the prisoner and read him the committal, setting forth, that in such a year, on such a day, in such a place, the investigating lawyer of such and such a district court, having examined so, and so, to wit, Mitya, accused of this and of that, all the charges were carefully written out, and having considered that the accused, not pleading guilty to the charges made against him, had brought forward nothing in his defense, while the witnesses, so, and, so, and so, and, so, and the circumstances such, and, such testify against him, acting in accordance with such, and, such articles of the statute book, and so on, has ruled, that, in order to preclude so and so, Monsieur, from all means of evading pursuit and judgment, he be detained in such, and, such a prison, a copy of this same committal to the deputy prosecutor, and so on, and so on. In brief, Monsieur was informed that he was, from that moment, a prisoner, and that he would be driven at once to the town, and there shut up in a very unpleasant place. Monsieur listened attentively, and only shrugged his shoulders. "Well, gentlemen, I don't blame you. I'm ready. I understand that there's nothing else for you to do." Nikolay Parfenovich informed him gently that he would be escorted at once by the rural police officer, Mvriky Mvrikaevich, who happened to be on the spot. "Stay," Mityu interrupted, suddenly, and impelled by uncontrollable feeling he pronounced, addressing all in the room, "Gentlemen, we're all cruel, we're all monsters, we all make men weep, and mothers, and babes at the breast, but of all, let it be settled here, now, of all I am the lowest reptile. I've sworn to amend, and every day I've done the same filthy things. I understand now that such men as I need a blow of destiny to catch them as with a noose, and bind them by a force from without. Never, never should I have risen of myself. But the thunderbolt has fallen. I accept the torture of accusation, and my public shame. I want to suffer, and by suffering I shall be purified. Perhaps I shall be purified, gentlemen. But listen, for the last time, I am not guilty of my father's blood. I accept my punishment, not because I killed him, but because I meant to kill him, and perhaps I really might have killed him. Still, I mean to fight it out with you. I warn you of that. I'll fight it out with you to the end, and then God will decide. Good, bye, gentlemen. Don't be vexed with me for having shouted at you during the examination. Oh, I was still such a fool then. In another minute I shall be a prisoner, but now, for the last time, as a free man, Dmitri Karamazov offers you his hand. Saying good, bye to you, I say it to all men." His voice quivered and he stretched out his hand, but Nikolay Parfenovich, who happened to stand nearest to him, with a sudden, almost nervous movement, hid his hands behind his back. Mitya instantly noticed this, and started. He let his outstretched hand fall at once. "The preliminary inquiry is not yet over," Nikolay Parfenovich faltered, somewhat embarrassed. "We will continue it in the town, and I, for my part, of course, am ready to wish you all success in your defense. As a matter of fact, Dmitri Fyodorovich, I've always been disposed to regard you as, so to speak, more unfortunate than guilty. All of us here, if I may make bold to speak for all, we are all ready to recognize that you are, at bottom, a young man of honor. But, alas, one who has been carried away by certain passions to a somewhat excessive degree." Nikolay Parfenovich's little figure was positively majestic by the time he had finished speaking. It struck Mitya that in another minute this boy would take his arm, lead him to another corner, and renew their conversation about girls. But many quite irrelevant and inappropriate thoughts sometimes occur even to a prisoner when he is being led out to execution. "Gentlemen, you are good, you are humane, may I see her to say good, bye for the last time?" asked Mitya. "Certainly, but considering. In fact, now it's impossible except in the presence of—" "Oh, well, if it must be so, it must." Grushenka was brought in, but the farewell was brief, and of few words, and did not at all satisfy Nikolay Parfenovich. Grushenka made a deep bow to Mitya. "I have told you I am yours, and I will be yours. I will follow you forever, wherever they may send you. Farewell, you are guiltless, though you've been your own undoing. Her lips quivered, tears flowed from her eyes. "Forgive me, Grushaw, for my love, for ruining you, too, with my love."
Mattia would have said something more, but he broke off and went out. He was at once surrounded by men who kept a constant watch on him. At the bottom of the steps to which he had driven up with such a dash the day before with Andrei's three horses, two carts stood in readiness. Mvriki Mvrikaevich, a sturdy, thick, set man with a wrinkled face, was annoyed about something, some sudden irregularity. He was shouting angrily. He asked Mitya to get into the cart with somewhat excessive surliness. "When I stood him drinks in the tavern, the man had quite a different face," thought Mitya, as he got in. At the gates there was a crowd of people, peasants, women, and drivers. Trifon Borisovich came down the steps too. All stared at Mitya. "Forgive me at parting, good people," Mitya shouted suddenly from the cart. "Forgive us too." He heard two or three voices. "Good bye to you, too, Trifon Borisovich." But Trifon Borisovich did not even turn round. He was, perhaps, too busy. He, too, was shouting and fussing about something. It appeared that everything was not yet ready in the second cart, in which two constables were to accompany Mvriki Mvrikaevich. The peasant who had been ordered to drive the second cart was pulling on his smock, stoutly maintaining that it was not his turn to go, but Akim's. But Akim was not to be seen. They ran to look for him. The peasant persisted and besought them to wait. "You see what our peasants are, Mvriki Mvrikaevich. They've no shame," exclaimed Trifon Borisovich. "Akim gave you 25 kopecks the day before yesterday. You've drunk it all and now you cry out. I'm simply surprised at your good nature, with our low peasants, Mvriki Mvrikaevich, that's all I can say. But what do we want a second cart for?" Mitya put in. "Let's start with the one, Mvriki Mvrikaevich. I won't be unruly, I won't run away from you, old fellow. What do we want an escort for? I'll trouble you, sir, to learn how to speak to me if you've never been taught. I'm not old fellow to you, and you can keep your advice for another time," Mvriki Mvrikaevich snapped out savagely, as though glad to vent his wrath. Mitya was reduced to silence. He flushed all over. A moment later he felt suddenly very cold. The rain had ceased, but the dull sky was still overcast with clouds, and a keen wind was blowing straight in his face. "I've taken a chill," thought Mitya, twitching his shoulders. At last Mvriki Mvrikaevich, too, got into the cart, sat down heavily, and, as though without noticing it, squeezed Mitya into the corner. It is true that he was out of humor and greatly disliked the task that had been laid upon him. "Good bye, Trifon Borisovich," Mitya shouted again, and felt himself that he had not called out this time from good nature, but involuntarily, from resentment. But Trifon Borisovich stood proudly, with both hands behind his back, and staring straight at Mitya with a stern and angry face, he made no reply. "Good bye, Dmitri Fyodorovich, good bye." He heard all at once the voice of Kalganov, who had suddenly darted out. Running up to the cart he held out his hand to Mitya. He had no cap on. Mitya had time to seize and press his hand. "Good bye, dear fellow. I shan't forget your generosity," he cried warmly. But the cart moved and their hands parted. The bell began ringing and Mitya was driven off. Kalganov ran back, sat down in a corner, bent his head, hid his face in his hands, and burst out crying. For a long while he sat like that, crying as though he were a little boy instead of a young man of 20. Oh, he believed almost without doubt in Mitya's guilt. "What are these people? What can men be after this?" he exclaimed incoherently, in bitter despondency, almost despair. At that moment he had no desire to live. "Is it worth it? Is it worth it?" exclaimed the boy in his grief. Part 4, The Brothers Karamazov, Book X, The Boys, Chapter 1. Kolia Krasotkina. It was the beginning of November.
There had been a hard frost, 11 degrees Réaumur, without snow, but a little dry snow had fallen on the frozen ground during the night, and a keen dry wind was lifting and blowing it along the dreary streets of our town, especially about the market place. It was a dull morning, but the snow had ceased. Not far from the market place, close to Plotnikov's shop, there stood a small house, very clean both without and within. It belonged to Madame Krasotkin, the widow of a former provincial secretary, who had been dead for 14 years. His widow, still a nice, looking woman of 32, was living in her neat little house on her private means. She lived in respectable seclusion. She was of a soft but fairly cheerful disposition. She was about 18 at the time of her husband's death. She had been the day of his death, she had devoted herself heart and soul to the bringing up of her precious treasure, her boy Kolya. Though she had loved him passionately those 14 years, he had caused her far more suffering than happiness. She had been trembling and fainting with terror almost every day, afraid he would fall ill, would catch cold, do something naughty, climb on a chair and fall off it, and so on and so on. When Kolya began going to school, the mother devoted herself to studying all the sciences with him so as to help him, and go through his lessons with him. She hastened to make the acquaintance of the teachers and their wives, even made up to Kolya's schoolfellows, and fawned upon them in the hope of thus saving Kolya from being teased, laughed at, or beaten by them. She went so far that the boys actually began to mock at him on her account and taunt him with being a mother's darling. But the boy could take his own part. He was a resolute boy, tremendously strong, as was rumored in his class, and soon proved to be the fact. He was agile, strong, willed, and of an audacious and enterprising temper. He was good at lessons, and there was a rumor in the school that he could beat the teacher, Dardanelov, at arithmetic and universal history. Though he looked down upon everyone, he was a good comrade and not supercilious. He accepted his schoolfellows' respect as his due, but was friendly with them. Above all, he knew where to draw the line. He could restrain himself on occasion, and in his relations with the teachers he never overstepped that last mystic limit beyond which a prank becomes an unpardonable breach of discipline. But he was as fond of mischief on every possible occasion as the smallest boy in the school, and not so much for the sake of mischief as for creating a sensation, inventing something, something effective and conspicuous. He was extremely vain. He knew how to make even his mother give way to him. He was almost despotic in his control of her. She gave way to him, oh, she had given way to him for years. The one thought unendurable to her was that her boy had no great love for her. She was always fancying that Kolya was unfeeling to her, and at times, dissolving into hysterical tears, she used to reproach him with his coldness. The boy disliked this, and the more demonstrations of feeling were demanded of him, the more he seemed intentionally to avoid them. Yet it was not intentional on his part but instinctive, it was his character. His mother was mistaken, he was very fond of her. He only disliked sheepish sentimentality, as he expressed it in his schoolboy language. There was a bookcase in the house containing a few books that had been his father's. Kolya was fond of reading, and had read several of them by himself. His mother did not mind that and only wondered sometimes at seeing the boy stand for hours by the bookcase poring over a book instead of going to play. And in that way Kolya read some things unsuitable for his age. Though the boy, as a rule, knew where to draw the line in his mischief, he had of late begun to play pranks that caused his mother serious alarm. It is true there was nothing vicious in what he did, but a wild mad recklessness. It happened that July, during the summer holidays, that the mother and son went to another district, 45 miles away, to spend a week with a distant relation, whose husband was an official at the railway station, the very station, the nearest one to our town, from which a month later Ivan Fyodorovich Karamazov set off for Moscow. The Kolya began by carefully investigating every detail connected with the railways, knowing that he could impress his schoolfellows when he got home with his newly acquired knowledge. but there happened to be some other boys in the place with whom he soon made friends.